Lisandra Garcia came to the United States illegally with her family when she was just 7 years old.
All I knew was that we were coming to El Norte, is what they called it, the north side. And for me, it was just a long journey of walking and being really quiet. Most of it was just confusing, and that's all I can remember.
On her 15th birthday, Lisandra's family gathered around the television as Barack Obama talked about Deferred Action for Childhood Arrivals, or DACA. Now the so-called Dreamer is enrolled in a pre-law program at Kansas City, Kansas Community College. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and Lisandra Garcia is with us now to talk about the contested future of DACA and how it's shaping her life right now. Hi, Lisandra.
Good morning. Hi.
When we spoke in February, you were staying optimistic. Has that changed since the announcement that DACA will end in 6 months unless Congress finds a more permanent solution?
I am still optimistic, but now I am uncertain of the future.
So what has been going on in your life since last time we talked?
Well, I am a legal assistant now, working at a small law firm in Olathe. And I got hired at a bank, and I'm still in school.
So part of what DACA allows is, in addition to a stay of deportation, the ability not just to study in the United States, but for students to get jobs here. So your employment situation seems like that would be one of the things that would be up in the air as far as looking ahead 6 months.
Yes, definitely. My employment is also at stake. My driver's license is at stake. And while applying to graduate school or just when I graduate, how am I going to get employed is also an uncertainty if nothing is done about DACA.
What is it that you do at the law firm as a legal assistant?
Well, we do a lot of filing, but mostly it's translating. Translating documents and documents of, immigration cases, just translating in court and just assistance to the attorney that I work with.
What is the dream for you as far as becoming a lawyer? When did it begin?
Well, it did begin as a dream because as a small child, that's what I thought I could become. And my parents did everything in their possibility for them to make this dream flourish. And so as I began my high school career and as I began my college career, that's the goal that I have to, get my bachelor's and then get enrolled in law school.
What did that dream look like before Barack Obama announced DACA?
Well, there was for DACA students before DACA, being really young and high school students don't get their driving permits until the 16 years of age, which is when you start finding out that you can't get a driver's license because you have no legal status. And so as a high schooler, early years in high school, I was not aware of these things.
Oh, you didn't really know that unless something changed, you wouldn't be able to go get a bachelor's degree legally here,
yes,
for example.
I didn't. Everything was a plan in my head, but I didn't really know how I was going to get there because I did not have the documents to get there. And so when DACA was announced, it gave me that possibility and that my dreams could actually become a reality, that I could actually enroll in school, that I could actually get a driver's license, that I could graduate and be employed.
So the process, we discussed this before, but it was a pretty intense bureaucratic process, kind of like going to the DMV and getting your plates renewed, but times 100.
Yes. Gathering all your documents was a hassle. And after that, you have to, and by what I mean by gathering all your documents, you have to prove that you have been residing in the United States for so many years. And then you have to prove that you have no criminal record at all, which is another document you have to gather. So basically, you have to be a contributing member of society and just being a positive having a positive effect in your community. If you're not that person, then you're probably not going to get DACA.
So When did you find out that you had received DACA status?
About 3 months in, I received a confirmation that immigration had my application, and then another 3 months to get the permit.
There's the process of applying for this means that you have, you know, revealed yourself to a bunch of authorities, and you know, should this program be ended, does that give you a layer of fear that you didn't have before?
It does. You have to come forward to immigration and say, I have no legal status. I came here illegally. And then you have to prove that you've been residing here. And once you do get your work permit, along with that, you are covered for deportation for 2 years or 3 years, however much time they give you. And after that, you have to renew it again. And it's like $500 or so to renew every 2 years. And if you aren't admitted, or in this case, if the program ends, you are not protected from deportation anymore.
The idea, this moment, you know, where you're looking at the next 6 months of your life, and you can't just look at your life in blocks of 6 months. You have to look at your whole future. How do you begin the process of making plans for both possible scenarios, the scenario where maybe nothing changes, or the scenario where maybe, you know, the stay of deportation is lifted, maybe your ability to work or study here legally and finish getting your law degree disappear?
Well, that is a possibility if Congress doesn't take any action, or if it's just completely ended in 6 months, then it's an uncertainty. You, like many immigrants in this country, now would have to probably work in an odd job, or like cleaning, or you know, working at a restaurant where they don't ask for my status, or they don't ask for a work permit. And so I know I have the possibility, and I know I am capable of graduating college. I know I am capable of graduating law school, but without DACA, without this program, with the possibility of deportation, then all of this ends. All of it ends.
Have you talked to the law firm where you worked about what happens in the next 6 months?
Well, your employer, if you're a DACA recipient, your employer cannot ask you about your status. They can't ask you if you have DACA, and they can't ask you when your permit ends. But if it does end and nothing is done in Congress to, you know, give another option, then it is something that I have to talk to my employer about, and then I'll probably get dismissed if nothing changes.
Do you consider, I mean, what is the investment like that you're making in your future law degree right now? If in 6 months you have to start over in some ways, what carries with you? I mean, have you thought about how you become a lawyer if DACA ends?
I am going to try to get as far as I can here in school. Even if DACA ends, I continue to plan on graduating with a bachelor's. Even if DACA ends, my plan is to still try to apply to law school and still try to graduate. But of course, even if I get to graduate, then I won't be able to work with my law degree. And so I've thought about the possibility of just... Actually, I haven't thought about it. And it's something really hard to think about. It's something I do think about for 5 seconds, and then I think, I don't want this to happen. There has to be another option. And so I know there is a lot of people which have DACA, and there's a lot of DACA supporters that are fighting right now, and it is what it needs to be done. We can't sit here and think for even 5 seconds about the possibility of not having this program, or not having a program like it that moves us forward into citizenship or residency. We have to fight to get something like it or better.
Yeah.
Yeah.
Let's talk to Miguel. Miguel is calling us from Atchison. Hi, Miguel.
Hello.
Hi, are you there?
Yes, I'm here.
What did you want to add to this conversation?
So I have, sorry, my baby's crying in the background. My entire family is basically in the entire immigration spectrum. I got to come to this country about 24 years ago, and we overstayed our visa like most people do. And essentially, just within the scope of my family, through marriage, two of us were able to become U.S. citizens. Through our family, some of us were able to become residents. And I currently still have a sister who's never left this country, came here when she was four, who's here because of DACA and is able to work. Because of our personal process in this, through the first basic 12 years after we lost our status, we had to basically pay for a work permit of $200 for each one of the six of us for about 10 years. And so, you know, it is a very, very complicated burden that a lot of people don't understand the complication. And you constantly get asked the question, well, why don't you just become a citizen then? And I think there's just a lot of ignorance in that process because they don't understand how many people it impacts and how it impacts a community. And more importantly, how it impacts the mindset or just the psyche of people who have to actually live with these kind of decisions.
Talk to me more about that last part of it, the psyche of people who have to live with this kind of thing.
Well, when I was 12 years old, my mom and dad sat us down and said, look, we have chosen to overstay our visa in this country. Don't commit any crimes that will get you or any of us deported. And that is quite the responsibility to put on a 12-year-old. But, you know, Ani felt like honesty was the best policy. And to a certain degree, I agree. And my wife and I talk about this all the time. But it's basically you kind of understood from the very beginning that you have a responsibility, not only to just when you come to this country, to be responsible for yourself and your family and to contribute to society. And we've been, you know, we came with a work visa that we overstayed. And so we've actually paid taxes. All of us came with Social Security numbers and we all have been contributing as far as taxes and things like that.
When you talked about the work permits that you paid for, that's something that I'm not sure a lot of people are aware of, that you can pay for a work permit to keep working after your visa expires.
So what happens is once you reapply through a different process. So once we overstayed our initial visa, which my father got through work, we applied for other visas to try to maintain our legal status here in the U.S. But for a variety of different reasons, that status prolonged itself for almost 12 years. Before it was essentially denied over time. But during that, every 2 years, we would receive temporary statuses. And so we would have to pay basically to renew that every 2 years while this process was still going on. And it just became costly.
And your sister is a DACA recipient. What's she thinking about right now?
Well, she doesn't have an option. I think what the conversation that's not being had is that for people much like your guest and my sister, they will overstay. There is no other. They will unfortunately have to live in the shadows, but they will overstay. They don't know the other countries that they're coming from. And really, a lot of times, our families came here because of the fear that of going back or even staying there. So it's just a reality that you have to kind of accept, and we as Americans have to accept as well.
Well, Miguel, thank you for calling.
Thank you.
Miguel talks about he talks about it as inevitable that you will be living in the shadows if Congress doesn't act in the next 6 months. Is that how you see it?
That is very true. Like I was telling you before, I am going to fight and make it a possibility for me to graduate with a bachelor's and go to law school, but even if I do get to graduate, then there's no employment for me because I have no work permit once DACA ends if nothing is done in Congress. And so also I think what was important that Miguel said was that there are so many people in our community that are affected by DACA, that are DACA recipients, and most people don't know. You know, the teacher that is teaching your children in kindergarten and the students that you see walking to school in the morning and even people like me that work, you know, translate your documents at the law firm, then were everywhere, and it's 800,000 people in this country that are affected by DACA and are going to see themselves affected and then living in the shadows once again if nothing is done. And so it is important that if you don't know, if you don't think there is anybody in your community affected by DACA, then you're wrong, because, you know, 800,000 people around you are affected by this. And it is important to educate yourself about this topic, because we are, like Miguel said, contributing members of society. We have no criminal record. And the only crime that we are committing right now is having dreams and doing something to achieve them. That is the only crime we are making right now. And so something has to be done. We can't just live in uncertainty for the next 6 months and then have Congress do nothing. So if you don't know what a DACA student is, if you don't know the things that we have to go through every 2 years to renew this document, then I invite you to visit uscis.org.gov. Then I invite you to educate yourself about this topic. And I invite you to, contact your representative about this topic and push them to support us, because the only thing we are trying to do is have a better future for ourselves and further a better future for our families and the children that we will have in the future. We are a generation of immigrants that got the chance to come out of the shadows. And what did we do? We got jobs. What did we do? We got enrolled in school, and now we have careers. Now we are working towards better careers. And so something has to be done about us. We can't just be living in the shadows again. No, we're going to refuse to do that. And if nothing is done, we are going to continue to fight and get that.
What does fighting look like?
We are going to, invade the streets. And like I am right now, I could have refused to do this because I could say, maybe somebody can get immigration on me or whatever. No, if you have a chance to speak out about DACA and how it has affected you, if you have a chance to tell people around you and to contact their representatives to support you, then that has to be done. We can't just stay silent anymore and be pushed back into the shadows. We can't do that anymore.
I know that this is sort of a shift, but can you tell me about how law school is going for you? Is there a class that has really inspired you and that makes you think about what you could do as a lawyer in this country?
Well, there are some classes that I'm taking in college, mainly history classes, that teach me about, events in the past. And we get to see that there have been many mistakes in the past. And
yeah, excuse me, you're pre-law.
Pre-law, yes, and have created the sufferment of many people. And so I think if I become a law student and I do become an attorney, I am able to help people and, be able to not have more mistakes done in history. I think if you get to affect others positively, that's good.
Lisandra Garcia, thank you so much and good luck. Stay in touch with us.
Thank you.
Up next on KCUR's Central Standard, an exhibit at the Kemper raises questions about identity politics and art. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. I'm Gina Kaufman. This is KCUR's Central Standard, and now we're talking about a show at the Kemper Museum of Contemporary Art called Magnetic Fields. It's a collection of work by women of color, and all of it is abstract. We'll hear from one of the artists in a minute, but I want to start by talking to the curator who organized the exhibit, Erin Jezik. Hello.
Hi, good morning.
What inspired you to start looking specifically at abstract art by women of color?
I think there was a lot of things. I think knowing artists, I think having studied with a collection in Savannah, the Walter O. Evans Collection of African-American Art, and seeing works by Alma Thomas early on. I also co-curated the exhibition with a colleague of mine, Melissa Messina, who's the curator for the Mildred Thompson Estate, who's one of the artists in the exhibition. And so collectively, we had this interest in looking at abstraction.
You mentioned Alma Thomas. Can you tell us a little bit more about her?
Yeah, Alma Thomas is really... she's a great figure in the exhibition. She's almost like the matriarch of the show. She's someone who created this sense of style that's wholly her own. And it was a perspective for her that was one that was observing the world around her. And she's been such an inspiration to so many generations of artists. And since the exhibition is intergenerational, a lot of the mark making that you see in the show really pivots around her work and her legacy.
She was the first African American woman to have a solo exhibit at the Whitney Museum in New York. That's a pretty big deal. That was in 1972. Mm-hmm. And one of the quotes I read from her really struck me. She said that focusing on color, as in the color in her artwork, had allowed her to spend her life immersed in beauty rather than what she called man's inhumanity to man.
Mm-hmm.
Can you talk about that idea a little bit? Because I think a lot of us would imagine that race, the race of an artist, might matter a little less when you're looking at abstract work than when you're looking at something that tells a story.
I think it's both things. I think that the artists are, you know, very aware of the world around them and their position in the world as women artists of color. But I think that there is a genuine interest in the trajectory of their careers leading into things like exploring the cosmos and looking at world news and discovering the patterns in the light and the gardens around you. Gilda Snowden was one who spent her time in and around Detroit, really kind of looking at the city, looking at what the city meant to her, as did many of the artists in the show as well. And so these patterns that they were finding around the world that they live in became more significant in some ways.
The whole idea of group shows that are like organize artists according to marginalized identities has been kind of controversial. So like Latina artists or African-American artists, group shows that bring them together and with the intention of celebrating what they do. On the one hand, that's been seen as making sure those artists get seen and noticed. But there are also artists who object to being known first and foremost for their race and not their art. And in that sense, I'm kind of curious from you, like where this show fits in that, because it is interesting that this is a chance for artists of color to be known as such, but not have to comment directly on race.
Right.
To be included.
Right. The exhibition celebrates abstraction. I think that, you know, looking at it from the perspective of someone who's curating at an arts institution at the Kemper Museum, I looked at the history of abstraction at the museum, and I have a genuine love and interest in abstraction. And when I opened my art history books, I didn't see any of these women artists. And so, you know, as I grew into my career and kind of started to discover more artists and talk to more people and to really talk to scholars who has made it their life's work to advocate for women artists of color, I started to really think about what this type of exhibition would mean here. And I think for me, you know, looking at the history of identity-based exhibitions, we really wanted to transition this into an exhibition about abstraction and learning through generations of women artists who have known each other and not known each other, but how that influence has carried through since the 1960s.
When you talk about opening art history books and not seeing these women's names, can you talk to me about how you did come to know them and their work and what that meant to you, how that maybe changed your idea of abstract art and who had been making it?
Yeah, I think it was through just a genuine interest in art and art history and the continued research aspects and you know, through job opportunities and things like that, I was able to be introduced to artists through collectors and through other artists. So it's really about building a really great network of people who introduce you to other artists. I mean, this show's a perfect example. We developed an advisory group who actually introduced us to several of the artists in the show. So we're still being introduced to the artists.
Is there someone whose work just, when you saw it for the first time, you just lit up and needed to understand more about this person and perhaps, yeah, why you hadn't encountered them before?
I think for me, in this exhibition, I mean, amongst many of the other artists, I think Mavis Pusey had a huge impact on me. I think that she comes from a design background, and so she has these kind of really conceptual, pared-down elements, but her style is not really well known, and it's shifted pretty significantly from the late 60s to the early 70s. And there's not a lot written about her. So I think as a person who's genuinely interested in research, that kind of like sets a light off in my head. And I just became incredibly interested in who's written about her work, who knows about her work, what collections she's in. And so it's still work to be done.
Do you think that race and gender, the race and gender of the artist, are important to know and do inform a work, even when it's abstract, even when it's about pattern and material and color, as opposed to this painting that depicts the story of a character, for example?
Right. I mean, I think yes and no. I mean, I think you should be able to come at a work and enjoy it for its formal properties and to really understand an artist's innovation in the use of materials. I also think, you know, digging a little bit deeper, it's great to know about some of the themes and influences that the artists have been working with. And I think that you know, for the viewer experience, it can come in so many different ways. And this exhibition, I think for me, lends itself to that, because you can explore it. You can explore the work through, you know, through looking at it through different perspectives that are happening in the world now. And you can also look at it work because it's just gorgeous. It's wonderful painting.
That seems like a good reason to look at art.
Yeah.
Definitely. Well, let's talk to Shanique Smith. She's an artist in the Magnetic Fields show. Hi, Shanique.
Hi.
Thanks
How
for
are you guys?
Good. How are you?
Feeling pretty good today.
So first of all, just what are your thoughts about being included in this show that gathers women of color who make abstract art together?
Well, this particular show, I'm super proud to be part of. The work is some of the best painting that I've seen in my life. And it's really amazing to be included in this mix of artists.
For you, why does abstraction speak to you?
Well, you know, I came to abstraction through the figure. And first having a romance with a figure that evolved into wanting to explore color and form, because I felt obligated to put a figure in everything.
Can you explain what you mean by that, by the figure?
I mean, I drew portraits and bodies in space, and where the figure moves and how it lives and breathes in a picture plane. That's what I mean. The curves of the body.
So it's the human form in particular that really spoke to you?
Yes, when I was younger. But then I started to feel this sense of obligation to put a figure in everything when I felt more drawn to color and shape. And that then evolved into an exploration of energy through line and through writing. My work has a lot of calligraphy in it.
Do you think that the idea of group shows that bring together artists around identity politics or just identity period, do you think that those are, that convention like elevates artists, or do you think that it can, I don't know, marginalize further?
Well, I don't think a show can marginalize women of color any further than they've already been marginalized, sincerely. I think that there's an assumption that other art shows have no identity. When it comes to artists who are of European descent, it's as though there's no ethnicity or identity within their work, you know. And when you show artists of color, it seems so apparent that it's so different, because I think the dominant culture is used to seeing themselves reflected back at them. So, sorry.
No. When you saw this show for the first time, did anything surprise you or no?
Yeah, so I was surprised and inspired by some of the artworks that I've never seen before. And I've heard of a good number of the artists, but there were several I had never heard of, which isn't shocking. But also, I think, to answer your question again, before, I think it's really necessary to have shows like this, but I think it's really important for institutions that have shows like this and galleries that have shows like this, whether it be women or artists of color, that they then follow up those efforts by having solo exhibitions of other artists and including them in their regular programming. So then it's not marginalizing, it's just extending the existing stories to show the full picture.
Erin, I mean, how will the introductions that you've had made in the process of organizing the show and the working artists that you've discovered while working on the show, how will that inform your curation going forward?
Well, I think the exhibitions that we've had at the Kemper Museum helped to inform this show first, which is great. We had a big solo exhibition by Chikaya Booker in 2008. And I think going forward, I'm learning so much about all of the artists, and I'm learning so much about what that might mean in terms of in terms of the artist's work's connection to our collection at the museum and to our exhibition history. And so, yes, I'm thinking about that all the time. I don't have any immediate plans at the moment for, 2018, but...
Shanique, you said that women of color could not be marginalized anymore, and can you talk to me a little bit more about how you have felt that in your career as an artist?
Well, you were asking whether or not shows that group women together, women of color, artists of color together, marginalized us. I'm just saying a show can't do that because we're already marginalized within the society. I think that there is a lot of assumptions in terms of the work, whether, we were talking about abstraction and the fact that it doesn't have a dominant narrative that depicts people of color within the work. And so it doesn't have a direct association with blackness, perhaps. So sometimes I think that that perception is troubling because some people only want to collect art that has that narrative so that it's overtly, quote unquote, black. And then on the
other hand, that would be the only opportunity for an artist of color to be known or recognized or understood.
Sometimes. And then on the other hand, I think people of color aren't as enamored or taken aback by a narrative about being people of color than the rest of the world seems to be.
Like you might want to just make art about whatever you happen to be seeing in front of your eyes.
Yeah, I think that work that overtly expresses a black experience should also be appreciated for its form and content and composition and the way it's rendered, just as well as abstraction. It doesn't mean that it's not about my experience as a black woman. It's even more about it because it involves my body and my actual clothing. So
can you describe a work of art that does involve like your body and your clothing and help our listeners understand what it is you mean by that?
Okay. Well, basically, I make sculpture with clothing and fabric, most of it my own. Those items from my grandmother's closet, her linen closet, and friends and family, and then some strangers as well. And I tie them together, and I make these veil-shaped forms that can be from 8 feet to palm-sized, lovingly tied bundles with ribbon and rope. And I also make these large-scale, expressive, gestural brushwork paintings that are based in writing and have lots of fabric and collage. So they're very physical.
Do you feel like that abstraction allows you to do something that the figurative forms didn't allow you to do, that work the ability to like work with these clothes and these fabrics and celebrate them for their materials and understand them in that way? Was that kind of liberating for you?
Sure. That's such a great question. Yes, the abstraction does more than that, because it doesn't depict life. It is life. It has the ability to collapse many different things into one place while expressing the actual energy of a feeling or a time frame or an event. Instead of just illustrating it, it embodies the actual energy of it.
Erin, as you look at so many different artists putting their own spin on abstraction, and abstraction is a very general term. I mean, it includes a lot of different things, and you're looking at people who have worked in different time periods, contemporary artists, people who worked in the 60s and 70s. Is there something that really rises to the surface for you that you think a lot of people don't understand about a collection like this, about this kind of work?
I think it's just about being really open to the perspectives of that you come to it with, and the idea that despite the fact that the artists were working in different generations, the way we've grouped them in the show kind of helps stylistically form a conversation between the artists. There's connections to artists who are using line. Shanique's work is very closely related to a Barbara Chase Raboud bronze sculpture. And there's this history of line that is in conversation between the two artists, despite the fact that they're using two completely different materials. There's some overlap there. But just to be able to have those different generations of artists and their formalistic qualities of their work present in the same space, you start to find things that you didn't expect. I think one of the biggest shifts in the exhibition was that in going through and selecting the work, there were so many surprises on the day that the installation happened that many of the works that we thought would sit next to one another just didn't. And the fact that they can still exist within the same exhibition, it just moves you through the space in a different way. And it's so unexpected and so surprising and so wonderful that I think that's what abstraction does, is it lets you have surprises happen.
Erin Jezik, Shanique Smith, thank you both so much.
Thank you.
Thank you.
Magnetic Fields, Expanding American Abstraction, 1960s to Today, is on display at the Kemper Museum through September 17th, so get over there and see it. Up next on this show, The Tacos of Kansas City, Kansas. I'm Gina Kaufman. Stay tuned. Welcome back to KCUR's Central Standard. I'm Gina Kaufman. On Saturday, the Kansas City, Kansas Public Library is having an outdoor Library in the Park Day, which is going to include a lot of tacos and a taco contest. That is because Kansas City, Kansas is becoming quickly known as the place to get a great taco in town. So we thought we would invite one of the taco purveyors on the scene to come tell us all his secrets, because he got second place last year. Alex Contreras, with us from Don Antonio's. Welcome to the show.
Thank you. It's a pleasure.
So tell me your thoughts about what makes a great taco.
Well, a great taco, well, there's a lot of things, and there's a lot of point of views of what makes a great taco. Traditionally, a taco is, you know, tortilla, no matter what the diameter it is. You know, it can be from 3.5 to 6 inch, and with the meat. And then you add your cilantro, your lime, your onion. That's more of a traditional taco. And then you get more into, you know, other cultures and other like Americanized taco, where you add the sour cream, the cheese, the lettuce, tomatoes probably. But yeah, I mean, a taco is a taco. tortilla and meat, that's basically what a taco is.
When did you start getting into making tacos yourself?
Well, it's been a long basically, my dad and my uncle started a store is called San Antonio's down on Kansas Avenue. My dad and my uncles, they started that probably in the early 2000s. And then, I've known the business since I was probably 13 years old. And then, you know, as time went by and everything, I got more familiar with the business. And then I actually quit working with my dad and my uncles for a little bit, I think in 2012.
Why did you quit?
I quit because I wanted to go back to school. I got the opportunity to actually go back to school and after I graduated high school from Sumner Academy. And I got the opportunity to go back to Johnson County Community College and try to finish construction management. So still in the process, you know, here and there. But my advisor, my teacher at Johnson County Community College, he told me, hey, you know, here's a place you could work at, Rue Materials. I started selling construction materials. And then last November, my parents actually told me, hey, do you want to share of the company, and do you want to be general manager? And I said, yeah, let's do it.
With the tacos.
With the tacos and the catering and, I mean, the whole store. But basically, I'm the one that's in charge of everything that has to do with the tacos, the catering, the food truck, the events. So I'm the man to go to if you ever go to Don Antonio's.
I mean, you mentioned that there are a lot of different perspectives on tacos and a lot of different ways to make them. And if you got second place in last year's contest in KCK, I'm guessing that you have a point of view on this.
Well,
one that you've committed to.
I think it was more of the people voting, and but actually, I think everybody that was there, because I knew the person that got first place. We worked together. I mean, if they need something, we're there to help them. If we need something, they're always here to help us. So basically, I think it has to do a lot with tortilla.
Tell me more.
You know, well, if you buy a packaged tortilla, it's gonna taste different from a homemade tortilla. And this is what we tend to do at our store, is we make our own tortilla shells. So I think what makes a great taco is the actual tortilla, whatever holds the meat and all the condiments that are in the taco.
That fresh baked tortilla smell is very recognizable when you walk into a place. But tell me about making tortillas.
Making tortillas, well, basically, there's not that much to it. I mean, there's some people add preserves to keep it longer. We tend to not put anything. We just put the Maseca flour and water. That's basically the only two ingredients there is for our tortillas. And we try not to burn the tortilla while it's making the process, or have it uncooked. Because, you know, if it's uncooked, all the tortilla is going to fall apart. If it's too burnt, you're going to taste that burnt taste every time you take a bite of a tortilla or a taco.
What is your favorite taco?
My favorite taco, there's actually three of my favorites, and I know if there's one, I like it, and if we don't have it, then I'll eat the other one. I like El Pastor, which is the marinated pork. That's probably one of my favorites, a little bit more cooked. And then second one would be the cow tongue. There's a lot of people that, you know, when they say cow tongue, and then they're like, what, do you actually eat cow tongue? And then, well, you know, we say, oh, try it. You know, we give them a little piece, and then they're like, oh, this is great. Give me a taco, give me two. And now we can't keep up with the demand of the cow tongue tacos.
Really? You've run out of those?
Yeah. It's a really high demand.
And then what is your third favorite?
Third one would be the steak steak taco. It's basically, you know, just chopped up steak and there you go. We don't do more of the ground beef. We do more of the steak. We actually cut everything. We slice everything and we cut everything by hand. So I think that's what really makes the difference from a ground beef taco to a steak taco, that we actually cut everything by hand.
Talk to me about seasoning.
The seasoning? Well, I mean, the seasonings, they're not that, how can I say this? The seasonings, they're more of, the pepper, garlic, salt. Salt probably is the key ingredient when you taste our tacos and someone forgets to add the salt to the tacos or to the, while they're cooking the meat, you could taste the difference right away.
So the salt is the key.
For the tacos and for any of the meat that there is for tacos, yes, I think salt is the key.
You know, just the idea that the tortilla and a seasoning as universal as salt, that those would be like the main keys to a great taco that you've shared with us, that seems surprising. Like, you know, these are not like crazy secrets. They're obvious secrets.
They're not. I think you have to know how much salt, know how to cook it. I think anybody can open up a taco business, a taco joint. But the family recipe and the way people cook it, because I could cook it one way and it turns out fine, and then someone else could try to cook it the same and it's not going to come out. And it's always like that with any food that you cook.
Do you have favorite memories of learning how to make tacos and coming up with your own technique?
My favorite memory will probably be my mom. Every time I would come back from school, from either elementary, again, this is as far back as I could remember. I mean, probably third grade to, you know, my senior year at Summer Academy was, I would ask her, "Hey, you got anything to eat?" And she's like, "There's some beans and some tortillas in the fridge. Go warm them up." And so, I mean, that's my favorite memory, is a bean taco.
And that you were sort of able to make those yourself.
Yeah, yeah. I mean, I've always been, I've always been in the kitchen, mostly in the garage now, but because I'm married. But I've always been, help my wife cook, or I've always been helpful in the kitchen, I would say.
When you look at the taco landscape of Kansas City, Kansas, and all the tacos that will be represented at the Saturday's event, the library in the park, what do you think about it? I mean, do you feel like there's great variety, or that it, what are your feelings?
There's a lot of variety that's going to be at the park, but I also think that we are missing a lot of other stores that could be in it too. I know there's probably limited space for us to be there at the park, so that's why there's only like 5 or 6 competitors. But throughout Kansas City and Kansas City, Missouri, there is a lot of taco joints that are really, really good. And I would say that the taco industry, or the Taco Tuesday thing, has really grown in Kansas City a lot.
Taco Tuesday as a phenomenon?
Yeah, oh yeah. Taco Tuesday has been really, it's really been an impact for us. Every Tuesday we get full, and I mean, it starts from 10 o'clock in the morning to 10 o'clock at night.
Well, Alex Contreras, with us from Don Antonio's, thank you so much for talking to us about tacos today.
Thank you. It's been a pleasure.
Library in the Park is this Saturday at Big 11 Lake Park, located at 10th and State in KCK. It'll last from 10 a.m. to 2 p.m. Don Antonio's will be there, along with a handful of other taco places in KCK. You can listen back to this morning's conversations at kcur.org/Central Standard. Tomorrow, we'll have a portrait session with Julian Zugasagoitia, the director of the Nelson Atkins Museum of Art. He's lived all over the world before calling Kansas City home, and he was raised by a star of Mexican telenovelas. The story of Julian Zugasagoitia, tomorrow at 10. KCUR's Central Standard is produced by Matthew Long Middleton, Sylvia Maria Gross, Jen Chen, Andrea Todd Hope, and Suzanne Hogan, with lots of help from intern Danielle Hogarty. I'm Gina Kaufman. Up to Date is next. Thank you.